So, as Charles K. Blandon purchased the Itasca Paper Company on behalf of the St. Paul newspapers, we've seen the hookup between him and Grand Rapids. And each would profoundly influence the other. And a whole new era is actually beginning for the town. And let us begin by getting acquainted with this C.K. Blandon and see where he's coming from. Charles Kenneth Blandon was born in the small Wisconsin town of Iola on April 2, 1872. Iola's right in the middle of Wisconsin. His father, Monroe Blandon, was a farmer who barely managed to eke out a livelihood for his family. When Charles was three, Monroe Blandon moved to New London, 30 miles from Iola, where for a time he operated a small hotel. Charles was the youngest of four boys. A sister followed in 1874. Blandon sometimes reminisced about his early life. One acquaintance remembered that, of his parents, Mr. Blandon always spoke with respect and emotion. Another described the parents on the basis of Blandon's comments as good, honest people, not overly blessed with the material goods of this world. An important source in writing papermakers was oral history, and in particular, interviews with many individuals associated in some way with Blandon. Some of those had been done earlier and were in the company archives. Some I did or had others do during the three-year period I was working on the book. I carefully went through those interviews, and I was looking for insight on Blandon, and throughout the book used quotes that were taken from those interviews, and they were based on what Blandon had told others about himself. I didn't attribute those to the name of the person who was writing the memories, because I didn't want to focus attention on them. When you're writing local history, many of those names would have been recognized, and people would tend to think of them, and I wanted them to think of Blandon. So I didn't use those names. Some people were disappointed with that when the book came out, but I think it was necessary to concentrate on Blandon. We'll be referring to many of those excerpts as we continue our story. Here is one from a personal employee, one who was employed in Blandon's household or his garden or as an attendant of some kind. He talked about his dad one time. His family had nothing whatsoever. It was just before Christmas, and he was barefoot and had poor clothes. Charles Blandon stood in front of a store window admiring a pair of shoes, and he said, "Daddy, come here a minute," and his father replied, "What do you want now?" Blandon asked if he could have that pair of shoes, and his father looked at him and said, "Son, if I had the money, you could have them, but I'm sorry, I can't get them for you." Blandon said he was always barefoot in those days. Then he stated, "Now, if my dad were living today, I'd give him everything he wanted." And incidentally, you have to be careful in terms of using Blandon's reminiscences because he does tend to exaggerate. Obviously, he can't be barefoot all the time. You can't go through a Wisconsin winter barefoot. So little things like that you have to watch for in those comments. But anyway, they're enlightening. And returning to the text, while attending grade school, Blandon found a job aiding the publisher of the weekly New London Times, where he acquired a lifelong interest in journalism and all aspects of publishing newspapers. At the age of 12, Blandon left school to become an apprentice at the Times, leaving school at the age of 12, and he never went back, never attended any more classes. 2 years later, young Blandon decided to leave New London and strike out on his own. He later recalled that all he had were a few personal belongings and several articles of clothing wrapped in a cloth slung over his shoulder. In the words of one of his biographers, "There were a mother's tears, a father's blessing, and out into the world trudged a 14-year-old boy, a youth prematurely on the verge of manhood." Blandon spent the next several years wandering about Wisconsin, sometimes finding temporary employment with small-town newspapers. That the quality of life during that period was not prepossessing may be gleaned from the fact that during a stay in the tough town of Hurley, he had only a large packing box for shelter. Blandon continued his travels, moving to southern Minnesota. For a time, he labored as a farmhand, but that brought him no greater degree of prosperity. He once worked during a summer and fall for a farmer who at the end of the contract period was forced to default on the wages due. But Blandin understood the circumstances well. After all, he knew of the poverty that could accompany a small farming operation from first-hand experience, and he bore the farmer no ill will. Blandin did have to return to a jeweler a coveted watch that he'd purchased on credit. Charles Blendon's determination and potential began to emerge when he decided to leave behind his menial farm jobs in favor of becoming a teacher. Wow, leave school at the age of 12, and now he's thinking of being a teacher. But with state standards for public school teachers not yet in effect in Minnesota, a teaching certificate could be obtained by passing whatever examination a local superintendent cared to administer. Blandin had learned much during his years working for newspapers, prepared himself, took the necessary exam, and passed. But he was among a small minority of certificate-holding rural teachers in southern Minnesota who by 1890 did not have at least some high school education and often normal school or teacher's training in addition. Even with that certificate in hand, finding a teaching job was not easy. In one of Blandin's personal scrapbooks is a clipping from a 1926 Minneota newspaper. The article begins, 35 years ago, a forlorn young man rode through the streets of Minneota on horseback, seeking a country school in which he might teach. He was unsuccessful, but he did finally get a position in Tyler in Lincoln County. And the story then goes on and recounts some of Blandin's later accomplishments as contrast for these early days. And it also provides insight into the problems faced by rural Minnesota teachers in the 1890s. In those days, residents of this section were largely immigrants, recent arrivals from the old country, most of them. And the difficulties that beset the school teacher at that time can well be imagined. The English language was spoken in only a few homes, and the patient labor of the teacher in importing knowledge of the language of the country to students could hardly overcome opposing influences at home. The teachers faced more than communication problems. In a 1916 Southern Minnesota history, the author states, "No class of citizens did more for the uplift of society or for the moral welfare of the public than did the teachers of early days. Under their capable care and keeping were placed an army of untutored young savages whose inclination to mischief knew no bounds. It was no small part of the teacher's work to instill into the hearts of those youngsters the sense of respectability and a desire for knowledge." Well, for several years, Blandin taught in various country schools, undoubtedly earning every cent of his meager light wages. Later, he liked to point out that he had just barely managed to keep ahead of his better students by studying every evening. A family member remembered this period, stating, "The one thing that comes to mind is a horse that he called Barney. Barney wore a straw hat with his ears poked through holes in the top, and C.K. rode that horse back and forth to school as a teacher." And another personal employee again, "He taught in a country school. He wasn't very old, and I think he had to go 10 or 12 miles morning and night to get to school and back. He didn't say too much about it, except that he felt he was a very good teacher." Well, during those teaching years, Blandin met Jenny D. Ackerman, who had been born in Pine Island, Minnesota, in 1871. The family moved to a farm near Marshall when Jenny and Jessie, her twin sister, were three. In 1892, Charles and Jenny married and for a time both taught school. When Jenny's family farm was sold, she acquired part of the proceeds, and for the first time in his life, Charles Blandin had access to a small amount of extra money. In 1981, the Blandin's granddaughter, Helen, observed that Jenny should have been given a lot more credit for aiding Blandin's career than she ever received because during the early years, she helped him get started. Seeing little future reward for teaching in small rural schools, Blandin and his wife began a new phase in their lives when they moved to Sanborn in 1893. For The little town of about 200 people was located in the midst of the great prairie country stretching across southwestern Minnesota. Just a decade and a half before the Blandins arrived, Laura Ingalls Wilder found inspiration for Little House on the Prairie in Sanborn's small neighboring community of Walnut Grove. Some of her stories certainly describe the lifestyle of the region very well. The open rolling prairie around Sanborn had first attracted settlers in the late 1860s. Families looking for opportunity in the rich farmlands of southern Minnesota traveled by train to Waseca, then continued for the next 100 miles in prairie schooners drawn by oxen. In the 1870s, the Winona and St. Peter Railroad Company extended tracks westward from New Ulm, inviting further development. The railroad tracks crossed the land of an enterprising farmer who in 1881 platted a town site, which he named Sanborn in honor of a railroad official. Although there was only one store on the site, he carefully laid out streets and lots on both sides of the tracks. 10 years later, when the town was incorporated, a dozen or so business places and a scattering of houses had been erected. The feeling prevailed that the community's railroad location pointed to a prosperous future. When Charles and Jenny Blandin arrived, they found a quiet little farming village. There was no electricity, the streets were unpaved and were lit with kerosene lamps. There were no telephones, there was no water system, there wasn't even a bank. The town's commercial activities centered on the railway depot, the stores, several grain elevators, and a little mill. Surrounding the community were vast acres of rich black farmland, primarily used in the 1890s for the cultivation of wheat. A large percentage of the population in and around Sanborn was of German descent. Even as late as 1914, an ad seeking a clerk for the town's co-op store stated that applicants must be able to speak German. Well, Sanborn was Blandin's choice as the place to launch a new career. The merchants wanted a newspaper to further the town's interests, and Blandin wanted to return to the business he knew best. This time, he was going to work not as a printer's helper, but as the publisher and editor of his own weekly. However, the new operation in Sanborn posed financial difficulty for Blandin. Funds were short. Blandin went to St. Paul, and there he managed to inveigle the printing press and other equipment and supplies that he needed. And another of his personal employees many years later remarked, "He told me of how he'd gone to St. Paul and ordered a printing press and other equipment. Those were before the days of buying anything on installment. And when all was ready to go, Blandin said, 'Well, I don't have any money. You'll just have to trust me.' They pondered over that, and they really didn't want to do it. But then they did and let him pay for it out of his profits. But the corker was that he didn't have any money for the freight either, and they had to pay for that too." Of course, he'd always chuckle when he told that story. And indeed, new phase for Blandin is certainly opening up here. And next time, let's see how he fares with this new newspaper of his.